Accession number 11474, Rule 1.
Mr. Riding, Reel 1.
Can you tell me how you came to join the RAF in 1941, please?
Yes, sir. At that time, I was a trainee apprentice draftsman for a firm of electrical manufacturers who made electrical motors, rotating machinery, in Trafford Park, Manchester. And as such, we were on a lot of Admiralty work, because I was on the direct current side, and we were doing motors for submarines. I remember doing them for the T-class submarines, the Thetis class and the Thames class, and we were doing motors for aircraft carriers. And as such, of course, when my calling up group came up, the company successfully stopped me from going as a reserved occupation. So as such, I saw adverts later in the paper for if you could volunteer for aircrew, that it didn't matter about whether you were reserved or not. They wanted you for aircrew, and you would have to take this little cutting out of the paper which showed an airman in his flying helmet to the local recruiting centre, and they would organise your call-up, which this is what I did. And as a result, volunteer for aircrew eventually got called up. And I can remember the chief draftsman, a man called Mr. Pollitt, who had served in the 14-18 war and obviously had a bad time. And he was most upset and made some remarks about, "You silly so-and-so, you're going to get yourself killed." But I wanted to join up, and so I volunteered for aircrew.
What was the pattern of your training? Can you take me through it?
I started off, I actually reported on my birthday, 12th of August 1941, then trained down to London, to Lord's Cricket Ground, where there was literally hundreds and hundreds arriving. And we were there for about a week. I know we used to be in flats just outside Regent's Park Zoo, and we used to have our meals in Regent's Park Zoo cafeteria that is now, or was, I suppose, then. And eventually I was shipped up to Scarborough, to 11 ITW, in the Prince of Wales Hotel. I did my 6 weeks basic RAF training and some navigation and one or two other things on armaments and signalling. And from there then I was moved to, we shipped to a transit holding at Heaton Park, actually, just outside my home in Manchester, where we were held there until we were drafted under the Commonwealth Air Training Plan to either Canada or Rhodesia. And I was pleased to get Canada, because a lot of my friends who were had a lower alphabetical, like B's or C's or D's, as opposed to mine being R, had already been told they were going to Canada on the call out. So I was pleased that I was called up for Canada as opposed to South Africa. And we sailed for Canada on Christmas Eve 1941 on the SS Bergen's Fjord.
What kind of reception did you get from the people?
Very, very good, actually, very good. We landed at Halifax about 2 days after New Year, I think. We were at sea all over Christmas and New Year, I well remember that, because we didn't have a very good time on board at Christmas. We had none of the traditional Christmas fare, and we were certainly not waited on by officers on Christmas Day dinner. And we had a rough crossing, and we were pleased to get ashore, and I was impressed and very enthralled and enthusiastic about the to see all the lights, all the Christmas tree lights still on the doors and on the Christmas trees in the windows. It was quite nice to see that from having come from blacked-out Britain. And I can remember the train stopping on the way from Halifax to the reception area at Moncton, where we were given apples and that by these Canadian ladies, great big red rosy apples, New Brunswick apples, I believe. And from there we carried on to I was eventually posted then to the EFTS, the Elementary Flying Training School, at a place called Caron, west of Moose Jaw, in the heart of the prairies. It had just opened up, actually. It was a brand new station, just been built. And we had to cross through by train. We had to go through Winnipeg. And we stopped at Winnipeg Central Station, I always remember, and they took us off the train, and we had this big reception in the concourse of the station, and we were treated extremely well there. And then we moved on then to this bare airfield right in the middle of the prairie, where everything is flat and all there was two or three grain elevators. And I started to do my pilot's flying training there in Tiger Moths.
How did you transfer from being a pilot to an observer?
Well, I did solo at 14 hours. You were supposed to solo before 14 hours, but the instructor wasn't very happy, and he said, well, you have to go now or you don't go, and I did go. But I didn't land too well, and I later found out that I suffered from astigmatism or something, in so much that I checked as we crossed the boundary fence onto the grass or the runway that I was checking the aircraft too early and literally bouncing it in. And of course, with a Tiger, you're supposed to make a nice 3-point kiss landing. You didn't make a powered approach. And I made two or three bumpy landings, and I did do another couple of hours solo, but I will always admit I was never happy. I was not happy about doing incipient spins or rolls off the top. I was never sick in air crew, but I wasn't. I began to realise that I wasn't really cut out for a pilot, and the chief flying instructor tested me, and he said, no, if you go as a pilot, he said, you'll kill yourself as a fighter pilot, and you'll kill yourself and your crew if you go as bombers. So he did a wise thing for me. It was very upsetting at the time, because the term washed out was an awful thing when maybe 30 of you were there and 28 of you or 26 of you were making flying training and you weren't. And you felt a lonely person when you were shipped away from the station and left a lot of your friends and moved to Trenton, where I was recategorised and remustered as navigator, or what was then the old type observer.
What were the duties of the old type observer?
Well, the old type observer had to do the full duties in the aircraft, assuming then that the aircraft was normally crewed by three or four people. So the observer did the observing, if you like. He did the navigation, and as such he had to be capable of navigating not only on dead reckoning, but also by astro navigation, that's navigating by the stars. And he also had to have a fair knowledge of bombing, so that he could fuse bombs and be able to bomb with the use of a bomb sight. And if necessary, he had to take a position in either the gun turret or a free-mounted gun turret and fire guns from the aircraft. So that is why, if you look at my record of service, that you'll see that I was a long time training, in so much that I did about 16 weeks, I think, from memory, on my main basic navigation course at a place called St. John, just outside Montreal. And from there, then Mont-Joli, a bombing and gunnery school, where we did bombing and gunnery in the old type fairy battles, and bombing generally from those aircraft or on the ranges or from Anson's. And then from there we were shipped out, right out over to the prairie again to the west of Winnipeg, to a place called Rivers, where I did my astro school, where we did nothing but took star shots, sun shots, and we navigated the Anson aircraft purely on astro navigation. We operated in a blacked out compartment, weren't allowed to look out and see the, because you remember, you're flying over Canada, so I mean you had all lights of all the cities and that, they were all burning, so I mean anybody could really spot where they were if they could read the map correctly, but you weren't allowed to come out of your blacked out queue and you had to navigate purely on the start. And from there then I was shipped to Summerside to do a general reconnaissance course, because I think at that time the policy of crewing aircraft had altered in so much that they realised they were going to have a lot more aircrew in these large bombers that were coming off the line then, like the Halifaxes and the Lancasters, and that to shorten the training programme, they decided that they would train straight navigators who then, instead of wearing the O brevet that we were given, had to wear the brevet with the N on. And then there was a bomb aimer who did just bomb B for bomb aimer. And of course we had the gunners with the air gunners. They split our duties up really amongst one, two or three crew personnel. So realising that we had done this sort of training, I realised this after, it wasn't obvious at the time, they sent us to this GR school at Summerside in Prince Edward Island, where we did a lot of low-level flying and a lot of identification of shipping and a lot of low-level reconnaissance and practiced low-level navigation. That is by drift and wind lane system as opposed to charting your course properly by wings. You did it by smoke floats and that, totally different to other navigation later on, like Astro and working from radar. And then I went to my operational training unit, where we crewed up, we formed crews, and I formed up with British navigators, and we formed up with Canadian pilots, Canadian gunners, and Canadian wireless operators on Hudsons, and I did my operational training unit on Hudsons. Having finished there, then we shipped back to UK, and from UK then we went to Thornaby on Tees, where we did another conversion unit, mostly to get familiar with flying in UK, to get familiar with a new type of Hudson, I think it was, a different mark to one we'd been flying, slightly different from the pilot's point of view, and where we were first introduced to the possibility of having eight 4-inch rockets, projectiles, fitted to the underside of the wings, as opposed to carrying depth charges.
Can you tell me how you flew the Hudson out from Britain to North Africa to join 500 Squadron?
Yeah, we shipped down to Portreath, the nearest point we could get to Land's End to take off, and we had a full petrol load. We had extra tanks in the Bombay, and all our kit, of course, and we were ordered to. We were routed. Well west of 12 or 14 degrees west to avoid interference from fighters from France. But we were warned that there was a possibility that we could be attacked by long-range condors. And we had an uneventful trip, really. Perfect weather, if I remember. Good navigation, no problems. And we made a landfall, more or less, on course, on time, on ETA. And then proceeded inland to land at a place called Fez, which was in Morocco.
What was the Hudson like to fly in for aircrew?
Well, it had from other aircraft which I was later to fly on. It was very, very comfortable from the point of view that the navigator could pass the pilot and could go down into his navigation position in the nose, where he had a table and all his instruments and plenty of room to manoeuvre. He could walk back up a couple of steps past the pilot and then walk back into the main body of the aircraft and see the turret, the rear gunner in the turret. So he had some movement really about the aircraft. It was reasonably comfortable. We did have a toilet at the back, and there was no restrictions, as I say, on movement. Its speed was reasonable, and it was, I gather from the pilot, quite a reasonable aircraft to handle.
Can you tell me more about the use of these rocket projectiles?
Yes, the standard attack procedure was that the pilot would aim the aircraft at about a 20-degree dive to the vertical, so he's virtually going straight down, and he would pick the target up on his ring sight, and as a navigator, you had to call out the heights, so that at 800 feet you would fire your first two, and at 600 feet your second two, and then at 400 feet your final four, and then pull out of the dive. And these rockets were armour-piercing and could penetrate the skin of shipping or submarines, which was obviously going to be our role when we joined 500 GR squadron, because we were on shipping patrol, anti-submarine, anti-attack by any German vessel.
Did the Germans attack you in Firefront when you were flying with Firefront?
We did not have anything on fighters, and I can't recall any of our my colleagues ever being attacked, any aircraft being attacked. Well, I think we were possibly too far away from the German bases. We were operating generally in the from the Straits of Gibraltar past Oran and past Algiers, and then handing over in the Bowen area to other aircraft which carried on with the convoys or the shipping, as it was, to those areas. And by that time, the First Army was occupying Tunisia, and the boys in the 8th Army in the desert were coming up to meet them.
Now, you joined 52 Squadron in August of 1943.
Yes.
Can you tell me what kind of duties you had with those?
Well, that was, again, a photographic reconnaissance role, but the aircraft was a Baltimore, which is a totally different aircraft. Again, an American-built aircraft, but totally different from the Hudson, in so much that it was a narrow gutted aircraft. It was a narrow fuselage, and the pilot sat in his cockpit virtually like a fighter pilot. He entered the cockpit over the wings and through the canopy, and he had no communication with myself, who had to go into the nose of the aircraft, or indeed to the wireless operator or in a rear gunner, which were behind him, behind his armour-plated seating. So I had to approach the aircraft when I was getting aboard, approach it from the nose, and climb up two ladders and get in through a hatch. And then I was in a sort of glassed greenhouse with this great big Perspex dome in front of me and a seat. And I used to have to navigate on a loose piece of board, no bigger really than an average tray that you used to have you eat your meals off, and but the pilot's feet were virtually on these rudder pedals, were above my shoulders, and to pass messages we used to tap his feet and pass it through if it was written, and then he'd do the same and pass it back to the wireless operator to send messages. The pilot, of course, was on his own, as I've said before, but the rear gunner and the wireless operator could in fact communicate with each other. The aircraft was, I forget the speeds now, but it was a reasonably fast aircraft. At low level, it could really move if the throttles were put through the gate, as we say. That is, we give it maximum power. And we could not outrun a fighter, but we could hold him if we were not surprised or caught or jumped, as we used to say, between the fighter, us and the fighter, and the enemy occupied land. Our role was low level reconnaissance, and we used to do this to avoid the radar at 50 feet. And for this, we carried no bombs, no rockets, no depth charges. We just carried a 2,000 gallon belly tank slung in the bomb bay. And we would leave North Africa, Tunis, and go up through the Straits of Messina at low level, Sicily being then occupied, so we went right through the back door at low level, straight through the streets of Messina at full bore, low level right through, and then we would go into Naples harbour as close as we could, and then on to Rome harbour, Civitavecchia, and then right up the coast to Spezia and Leghorn, and then back down Corsica, through the Straits of Magellan if need be, and down through Sardinia, across the coast, down by the coast of Sardinia, left or right, depending on as we were directed, and then past Sicily and then back into base. And this took us between 8 to 10 hours, depending on the route, and we used to call it the milk run, because we would go first thing in the morning, first light. In fact, we used to do the first leg, if possible, for the first half hour in the darkness, and it was a bit hair-raising at 50 feet, and we kept low to avoid the radar, and it was very, very tiring on pilots and tiring on navigators and tiring on gunners, because they were constantly sweeping the sky for enemy activity. So, in effect, really, we only did one of these trips roughly once every 6 days, maybe. We did meet the odd fighter, but fortunately, when we did spot them, we were seaward of them. And as I said before, if we did put the aircraft into its low-level position and really go, then they may be able to catch you, but with the long-range Gallen tanks on, you could burn the fuel, and they wouldn't risk carrying you further. They wouldn't risk chasing you further, because they would be burning their fuel. And then they had the fight to contend with afterwards, because we were reasonably well armed with really well armed aircraft, actually. The wings, we had 8 machine guns in the wings, which is equivalent to the Spitfire pilot of those, Spitfire aircraft of those days. And we had a turret which had 2.5s in some cases, Brownings, or 4.3s. And then we had these scare guns, fixed guns, in the bottom of the waist, which were operated by the wireless operator or the rear gunner, depending on the arrangement. I mean, they could only fire when they... But they would have been useful if a fighter had come up underneath your tail. You could have... You wouldn't be firing them with any degree of sighting, but you could certainly show that you were firing at him, and that might have deterred him. Hence the word scare guns. They were very, very well equipped that way as regards armament, and extremely fast. And we used to do these trips until Sicily was invaded, when we did some support of Sicily invasion.
Do you remember anything about the Sicily landing?
Not a lot, really. Because most of the landings were at night. We did support a bit during the day, but it was mostly looking for shipping. German E-boats or destroyers which might have attacked our convoy of bringing in the men and the tank landing craft, etc. We were then dispatched back on our normal role, which was to range further up to see what reinforcements he was bringing down, and then we would spot, if we spotted any shipping, then we would immediately climb to hide, break radio silence, broadcast in plain language position and what we had seen, and then our strike bullfighters with torpedoes would take off. They were attached to the same wing, or if it resulted in a night attack, then our Wellingtons would take over, our night Wellingtons.
I think you also supported the Salerno landings.
Yes, we did.
September.
Yes, I did. Yes, we did the same. And again, the role was the same. We were to recce behind the. Behind the sea line, the invasion line, to see what was happening inshore, behind the invasion beach. And I remember that the British were ashore when we were briefed, but the Americans were still having problems to get into actually get a foothold on the first day. And I think they did eventually get ashore around about afternoon time. And we supported them for 2 days. And then reverted back to our original role of going further north and checking for shipping, because I think at that time Germany had brought this radio-controlled bomb operated from a Junkers aircraft. And I do know that he'd sunk a Littorio class, or the Littorio Italian battle wagon, when it was coming in to surrender. And I think from memory that it also damaged the Warspite. And so we were looking for this type of target up to Rome and beyond to see if he was reinforcing from Leghorn and Spitzia and that way. And then, of course, towards Christmas time, we pulled out from Sicily, where we had been stationed. When we took over Sicily, we moved to Sicily, obviously, to get our range down. We didn't have to fly from North Africa then, or Malta. We cut the range down. And then when we were consolidated in the Salerno area, we went and operated from Monte Corvino. So we were up then towards the Volturno, I think it was, and I think our lads were up to about Cassino by that time. So certainly it was occupied as far as Rome, certainly up to Cassino, and we were doing the same role, checking for shipping. And he was pulling out then of Sardinia, so we were keeping a check on that to see what targets were presented with all the evacuation of his troops. And then finally into Corsica, where he made his final evacuation from Bastia, the port of Bastia, across to northern Italy.
I think you saw the Italian fleet surrendering at Malta, did you?
Yes, I wasn't there when it actually surrendered. One of my colleagues was flying. We were flying between the Straits of Magellan, and which was between Corsica and Sardinia, and they saw this huge array of battleships and cruisers and destroyers. And he immediately climbed to height and, in plain language, Italian fleet at sea. And the word came back, a shadow, and which is what he did. And, of course, they were steaming to surrender. And the following day, or the day after, we were detailed to sort of fly the fringes. And we had these cameras and we took some fantastic photographs of the Italian fleet steaming in the van to surrender at Malta. I always remember that. A very clear memory of that.
Can you repeat to me the incident that you recounted to me earlier about where you had a lucky escape in Bastia Harbour?
Oh, yes. Well, Bastia Harbour is... there's a peninsula at the top of Corsica. It sticks up like a thumb. And Bastia Harbour is tucked round the eastern side of this peninsula. And we were rounding this peninsula at 50 feet. As I say, we always used to fly at 50 feet to avoid radar and surprise. And we cruised into Bastia Harbour and were amazed at the number of ships that we saw there. And if you came across enemy activity, you were always briefed to fire off any cartridge, a letter of the day. You didn't fire off the letter of the day, but you fired another cartridge of a different colours. And I, as the navigator in the front, would operate the oldest lamp and try and do some form of recognition signal. And this, usually, we used to say, would put off the gunners just for 1 second or maybe 10 seconds to give you just a chance. And our shape, actually, was not unlike a Ju-88. It was a Baltimore, particularly the rear fin and the way the engine sat on the wings. It had a quick glance, and so the Germans must have mistook us, actually. And they gave us that breathing space, and we managed to turn around and expose our underside of our fuselage and pull out. But we were suffered. We did suffer a lot of ACAC fire and, indeed, light machine gun fire. That was really my only scare in that area at that time.
Were those German ships dealt with?
Oh, yes, yeah, they were operating. I think the word was called a Siebel ferry. I think it was like a great big floating pontoon or raft. And they used to run the vehicles on it. And they had this sort of flak tower arrangement in the middle, like a miniature oil derrick. And they relied upon that for air defence. We reported all this, and I do know that our strike bow fighters and other aircraft did have quite a killing there. They did knock off quite a bit of transport going back, because he was evacuating during the day, which normally evacuated at night, of course, if possible. But he was evacuating during the day. I suppose his front had collapsed and he had to get out quickly.
You tell me that was shortly after Salerno.
That was shortly after Salerno, yes. I'm not too sure of the dates, but I think it would be in October sometime.
Now, after your 52 Squadron experiences in Italy, you returned to the UK to 69 Squadron.
Yes, we left there, was it March in there?